Have you ever felt a twinge of worry about AI taking over your job or diluting your creativity? Well, what if you could turn that fear into creative fuel? We've just published an amazing new ebook called The 4 Keys to Success in an AI World, and this is more than just a guide. It's a deep exploration into the human skills that AI can't touch, the skills that are essential for standing out and thriving no matter how much technology evolves. We're talking about real differentiators here like creativity, emotional intelligence, critical thinking, and much more. Inside, you'll find actionable insights and strategies to develop these skills, whether you're a creative person, a business person, or just simply someone who loves personal development. This isn't a story about tech taking over. It's a story of human creativity thriving alongside AI. Picture this: AI as your creative co-pilot, not just as a tool, but a collaborator that enhances your unique human skills. The 4 Keys ebook will show you exactly how to do that and view AI in a new way that empowers you instead of overshadows you. Transform your creative potential today. Head over to unmistakablecreative.com/4keys. Use the number 4, KEYS. That's unmistakablecreative.com/4keys. And download your free copy.
I figured it out, you know, but figured it out makes me sound like I'm smart, you know, in that way. No, I figured it out. That is, no, just stick to it. Just keep at it. And the adage of the harder you work, the luckier you get. Is what happened, honestly. And so I ended up, you know, tripping into reality TV at its inception because somebody took a chance on me, you know, and it flourished from there. The poetry thing continued, just because, I'll write all of my life, you know, regardless of whether I get paid to do it.
I'm Srini Rao, and this is the Unmistakable Creative Podcast, where you get a window into the stories and insights of the most innovative and creative minds who've started movements, built thriving businesses, written best-selling books, and created insanely interesting art. For more, check out our 500-episode archive at unmistakablecreative.com.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad, and I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive & June. Olive & June gives you everything that you need for a salon-quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive & June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive & June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
As creators, we're always on the move. Whether it's a live podcast event, a pop-up shop, or a workshop, we're constantly interacting with community, and that's where Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe comes in. Imagine this, you're at a live event, a listener loves your merch, or a participant wants to sign up for your course on the spot. With Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe, you can accept their payments right there and then, right from your iPhone, so there's no extra hardware or no delays. Total game changer. It's not just for creators. Any business owner can do this. It's about making transactions smoother and much more personal, growing your business in your way. We've been using Stripe for our products and courses for a long time, and now with Tap to Pay on iPhone, you can take your business to the next level too. So visit stripe.com/tapiphone to learn more. Remember, folks, with Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe, your business is always at your fingertips.
Donnie, welcome to The Unmistakable Creative. Thanks so much for taking the time to join us.
Thanks for having me. I'm excited to be here.
Well, it is my pleasure to have you here. So as I was saying before we hit record, I found out about your work through Cher Hale, who is literally the only publicist that we have never once said no to. She has a remarkable track record with us. Anytime my friends ask who should I hire as a book publicist, she's the person that I say they should go to. So absolute pleasure to get in here. Before we get into your work, I want to start asking you, what did your parents do for work? And how did that end up shaping the choices that you've made throughout your life and career?
My dad was a postal worker for 35 years after the Air Force, and my mom was a nurse's aide. So, the working class family in Pittsburgh. Uh-huh. And in terms of how it shaped my upbringing, lots of ways. I mean, some of them invisible that I couldn't even tell you, I'm sure. But the ones that I'm super aware of have to do with work ethic, for one. My parents worked very hard and encouraged me to work hard and to be consistent and reliable. And also, I guess an offshoot of that was the notion of integrity and being honorable and being true to your word. And some of that certainly got reflected in the workplace, but they also wanted it to be reflected in how I treated other people, how I kind of showed up in the world, as a young Black kid in a world that wasn't necessarily built for a young Black kid. So those are some of the ways that I think what my parents did for a living and how they invested themselves in work and honor and integrity. I think those are things that informed who I am.
Yeah. So, I mean, with your dad as a postal worker, I mean, and your mother doing what she did, like, I mean, these seem like very consistent, predictable career paths that have a very, very linear arc. And of course, just from knowing what I do about you, I know yours hasn't been that. What did they teach you about making your way in the world? Like, what did they teach you about careers? What advice did they give you? When you present a path like this to them, what do they say to it?
Well, that's interesting because they didn't present a path to me. What they did was nurture me being like a bright, shy kid. And so they certainly encouraged reading, and they were very supportive of my academic success. And because there was no kind of pathway beyond working class life, they really couldn't envision what I would be. I think part of it was just a great reservoir of hope that it would be something beyond what they were doing. And so it was just a constant diet of being boosted up. So basically, whatever you're doing, keep doing that. And, keep bringing A's home. And why is there a B? And I bet you can do better, that kind of thing.
sounds a lot like an Indian family.
Yeah, and but I guess what is implied in that is we know you can, as opposed to something lofty and unreachable. The unspoken assumption is that we know you can, and only in hindsight did I realize that that was the thing, that level of confidence in my ability to do things was kind of a lifeblood, and definitely informed my willingness to take risks and try things that nobody else in my family had the opportunity to do or the interest in doing. So I think their support allowed me to be risky in a family where people did take stable jobs because risk wasn't a way to put food on the table.
Yeah. Well, so in addition to that, so, you know, one of the things I thought was interesting that you said was you said, you know, for them, they didn't put a path in front of you because of the fact that they couldn't see, you know, sort of beyond the working class life that they had. So as a young boy with, you know, them as your parents, how did you find the vision for what your life could be when that's what they could see? But obviously you saw something else.
And I can't take credit for being, you know, this amazing visionary, honestly. You know, part of it is just kind of tumbling through it. But what they did do is encourage education. And so, you know, I basically lived in the hood, you know, in Pittsburgh, in a neighborhood called Homewood that I cherish to this day. But, you know, the schools in Homewood at the time were, the public schools were not the best. And so they sent me to Catholic school, which was the equivalent of a prep school, even though we were Baptist and, you know, certainly didn't practice Catholicism. But those were the best schools in the city, basically, in terms of preparing someone for, you know, a life and education. And so what they were, I think, prescient about was being able to place me in a very educationally rich environment so that whatever seed I had could flourish. So I think, you know, I thank them constantly for having the foresight to do something like that. And they didn't know how it was going to turn out. And of course, neither did I. And as, you know, as I just kind of, you know, propelled through that system, you know, what that does is it provides options. It provides opportunities for one to risk, to try new things, to fail, and to learn from those failures. And so being in an academically rich environment allowed me to grow, to find my best smart self, if you will. And through that, I discovered things that I wouldn't have ordinarily discovered. Nobody in my family before me had graduated from college, for example. And so that was a path that seemed organic, seemed natural based on my academic success in high school. So the goal was, okay, I guess you go to college now. And didn't know what to major in, didn't know, you know, what that was going to mean at the end of it. But in 11th grade, I took a psychology course because I was trying to avoid a hard science class. And that was an elective that I could take. And up to that point, I thought I was going to write for a living. Started writing when I was 8 and thought that was going to be, you know, who I was. But I didn't have any idea how to make a living at writing, except, you know, I had heard of journalism. That didn't seem to be quite it. But then the psychology class kind of exploded my thinking about what I could do, because it tapped into what I, as a shy, bookish kid, was already doing, which was paying attention to people, trying to figure out how they tick. And for me, I was writing and, you know, trying to be creative in my exploration of that. But this was a whole discipline that was about trying to understand people. And it was this eureka moment. Hey, I'm going to do that. And so I majored in psychology and off I went, you know, to undergrad, having no idea what that adventure was going to be. But it was the beginning of a grand adventure, as it turned out.
Yeah. So I think that what's fascinating to me is you have a contrast of two environments, right? You mentioned you grew up in the hood, but then you went to what were the best public schools or the best schools in Pittsburgh at the time. And I have so many questions about this around race, around community, but let's start with the environment piece, because, you know, I wonder, when you have an environment like the one that you grew up in, you know, and then you go to school in an environment that's completely different, how is it that you managed not to succumb to the environment that you're in at home or in your neighborhood? And also, this is a question I asked one of our former guests who had happened to be a white guy who grew up in South Central LA, like in an all black neighborhood. When we look at this stuff, you know, and I was asking him because, and I'm very curious from you, because as a black person, your perspective, I think, would be interesting because, you know, he was a white guy giving me his perspective. But, you know, when I look at neighborhoods like that, like my perception of neighborhoods like that is, I probably guarantee you, completely inaccurate, because my entire perception of it is based on having seen John Singleton movies like Boys in the Hood. So when you look at how media portrays environments like that, what do you think that we misunderstand? And why is it that we get somebody like you who comes out of a neighborhood like that and accomplishes what you have and transcends the environment? And then on the flip side, you get people like the characters in Boys in the Hood, or the people who end up in prison.
I think it's easy to cherry pick, you know, the high profile things. If you have a media culture that, you know, if it bleeds, it leads, et cetera, it's often going to pick the high profile but low incident events, because those are more sensational. Those are more interesting to get people to watch your program. And so what it does miss, it does miss the things that are mundane but beautiful at the same time, loving families and intact households and a camaraderie between people of the same cohort. So that's not interesting for the news, because the news traffics in exceptions. And so I think one of the things that we have to keep track of is the media is going to show you the things that differ from the mundane, because that's what makes sense for ratings. I think we should absolutely worry if what the news is doing is showing us just good things, because that means that's the exception to the horrible things that are happening in the news. So I think that's one of the things that the narrative about urban life misses, because of how we're built to learn things in terms of our media culture.
Yeah. Now, as far as, you know, sort of transcending the environment, you know, why is it that, like, what is it that happens to somebody who doesn't end up in your situation and life goes, you know, kind of into disarray for them?
And, you know, there's a novelist from novelist and writer from Pittsburgh, from Homewood, in fact, John Edgar Wideman, who, you know, grew up in the same neighborhood that I did, and has a brother, and his, you know, he ended up, you know, as a writer, his brother ended up going to prison for life. And so under the same household and same neighborhood. And so it's ineffable what can happen, you know, in a family because of how people are put together and how the environment reacts to how people are put together. It's sometimes hard to say. I mean, again, that's the same household and two different outcomes from siblings it's not like they were 20 years apart and, you know, generationally different. And so that's a fascinating study, sadly so for me, but it happens all the time. And I can certainly name people who grew up in the same neighborhood that I did and, you know, that I don't consider myself smarter than they were, and their lives didn't turn out, you know, the way mine did. One of the things that I had that, you know, that was the bedrock for me was, again, my parents' commitment to nurturing, you know, this shy, bookish kid and you know, blocking for me and getting stuff out of my way. And so, you know, growing up bilingual, bicultural in that sense. So, you know, yes, I had to negotiate what was true about my neighborhood and still, you know, wear a necktie in school, you know, for 12 years. And so that level of agility and versatility was a survival tool, and it served me well. Didn't know. And again, I can't, I don't want to place myself as this person who was so aware of how nimble I was becoming. It just happened, you know. I grew up and survived it all, and so I can't take full credit for all the good things that were, you know, propping me up. But I think I've tried to be, you know, to my other point about how I grew up, honorable, you know, to what my parents fed me, you know. So I tried not to, mm-hmm. to waste those things and tried to, you know, take some of the risks that they couldn't.
Mm-hmm. So, you know, we've had, as you might imagine, a lot of conversations about race this year. And so given where you grew up, I couldn't help but ask you about it because, you know, you mentioned that, you know, you grew up in a world that was not really, you know, suited or not designed for a young Black boy to thrive. So what were race relations like at the time when you're growing up? And what did your parents teach you about race?
Yeah, that's, you know, I'm fascinated by it still as I look back, because I grew up in a time when, you know, things were kind of in transition, you know, going from, you know, from colored to Negro to Black to Afro-American. You know, I mean, that was an interesting trajectory, and watching that happen as the neighborhood was also in transition and becoming more Black. Whereas before it was pretty diverse, and I would say it leaned more toward, you know, predominantly white. Watching that happen, so, you know, being someone who grew in his ethnic identity at the same time the neighborhood was growing in its identity was just a fascinating parallel as I look back on it. And so, you know, what my parents often talked about in those early discussions about race. We didn't have the talk that Black parents have to have, I think, with their children now about the danger of being Black with law enforcement. It was more about being respectful and being making sure that you were a good example of what Black people could be, because people's perception was so skewed in the opposite direction. The goal was for me to make sure that I wasn't feeding into those stereotypes. So be polite, be respectful, you know, be honorable and have integrity, et cetera. Because the prevailing narrative, because people didn't spend a lot of time really interacting with each other, was stereotypical.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, it's funny because, you know, Isabel Wilkerson wrote this brilliant book called Caste, which I had, mm-hmm. you know, alluded to in a previous conversation with Laura Robbins, who's a writer for Huffington Post, who was here. And I had a fascinating conversation with her about this around stereotypes and where they come from. And stereotypes are fascinating to me because, I mean, you know, the funny thing is, like, stereotypes in a lot of ways, you know, they get shaped by kind of our experiences. So we make broad generalizations based on individual experiences. So we turn, you know, a individual experience into universal truth when it comes to stereotypes. And I mean, I, even as an Indian person, you know, I know that there are things that people have as stereotypes about us. But what I wonder about your life experience, like, what do you remember as one of your first experiences with racism?
And I appreciate the question because it is important to kind of map out, you know, what's the constellation of racism in any given person's life, because it will differ from time to time. And so yeah, I like talking about it just because it has been such a journey, you know. So you know, one of the earliest recollections had to do again with the academic environment that I was in, and I wrote an essay, you know, as a part of a class assignment, and I was like in the second grade, and you know, they asked us to write some stuff, and I used the word ritual in my essay, and the teacher thought I had copied it from somewhere. She thought somebody else had done the work for me, because there's no way that I should know that word as a second grader. And her countenance about it was, and at least my interpretation about it was, you little black boy couldn't possibly know that word yet and use it correctly, you know, in a sentence. And so it became this inflamed thing where my parents had to come to the school and basically explain to them, look, this is a kid who's been reading, you know, since he was three. He reads the dictionary for fun. Yes, he knows that word. He uses it regularly. And in addition to a whole bunch of other words that are certainly beyond what you would expect a second grader to use. And he is, if not equal to, perhaps superior to some of the to other kids in this class. And we kind of insist that you recognize that and not accuse him of malfeasance. And so, and at the time there was no discussion. I mean, she didn't say you little black boy this or that. But in the aftermath, in the postmortem of it, my parents talked about it as a racial incident. And I hadn't made that connection at all, honestly. And I was one of maybe two black kids in the class of a dozen. And so that was the first time I had to think about people's perceptions of me, including this element in a way that wasn't positive, that somehow detracted from who I was. And so it was a very complicated moment, but I do consider that kind of my first recollection of the awareness of race as a negatively valenced thing.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much, but when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Yeah. Well, I don't know if you've ever seen the movie Finding Forrester with Sean Connery.
Sure.
But that almost exact scene plays out for the young kid. He ends up writing something because he's this incredibly talented basketball player, and he goes to some fancy prep school in New York, and he ends up writing something that's so brilliant that the teacher actually questions whether it's his. And then finally at the end, Sean Connery comes in and reads it. And he says, you know, I had to come and read this for my friend Jamal because he wasn't allowed to read it, but these are his words, not mine. You know, and that, it just reminds me of that.
Yeah. And, you know, I've said there's been many incidences, you know, that resemble that one where, you know, the unfortunate compliment of somebody being surprised at how well you did something. And I resent that level of surprise, you know. And it went through this. I've been through this in every, you know, iteration of my academic life for sure. And in some cases, in my personal life where people are talking about how articulate I am and, as if that's a surprise.
right.
And, you know, obviously, you know, Chris Rock has joked about it with, you know, talking about Colin Powell in terms of like what were you expecting? You know?
Yeah. It's like when my parents, you know, somebody tells my parents, oh, it's like your English is so good. It's like, well, we've been here for 25 fucking years. Of course, your English is decent. You know? And it's funny you mentioned this because, you know, my dad is a college professor, and, you know, you're an academic, so you know how the system goes of like tenure and then, you know, promotion after promotion. And I've had to literally rewrite rebuttal letters for him because he's been denied promotions that were like completely not factual. I looked at them and he's like, yeah, none of this is true. And I was like, well, then why is this happening? You've been at the university for 25 years. And it was shocking to me that, you know, in an environment like a university, he actually said, he's like, in all honesty, he said it's partially racism. And I could not believe that, you know, after this long, I mean, and he's been there for almost 30 years at this point. So what I wondered now is, you know, having grown up the way you did in the neighborhood that you did around the time that you did, when you look at where we're at now, and part of the reason, you know, I wanted to talk about this in particular is because as I was reading the poems, I noticed that a lot of your poems centered around specific events, which we'll talk a bit about. But when you see where we're at now and you see where how you grew up, like, how do you feel? I mean, hopefully with, you know, the election of Biden, you know, we're going to get out of this mess. But, I did see somebody say, it was actually a woman on Trevor Noah. I think she was a sociologist of some sort, a black woman. And he was talking to her about some of this and you know, two-party systems. She said, you still have to remember 70 million people voted for Trump. And many of them, you know, she said, it doesn't change the fact that we live in a divisive society just because we have a new president.
It's chilling, the number of people who voted for him, and the fact that, you know, we're verging on 2021 and that's still a thing. It's stunning. And as much as there is to celebrate, you know, there's at least 70 million other things to be fearful of. And even though I've been fortunate and I've worked hard. And so I've managed to get some of the prizes, you know, I have doctor in front of my name if I really want to insist on that. You know, I have a couple of, Emmy awards. So that's the biggest prize you can get in the profession that I'm in and, you know, and I'm still alive. And so, but even though those things are true, nobody, pulling me over, at a stoplight, is going to see any of those things. They're just going to see a black dude in a car. And so yeah. I have to go through all of the algebra of what can this turn out to be? Because I don't have time to list my CV for this cop.
Right.
And I have no idea what all of his history has led to in terms of how he perceives me as, you know, a 200-pound muscular black guy in a car.
Yeah.
And so that's a different narrative, especially when you look at the what can be perceived as a dysmorphia in terms of law enforcement often misperceiving, you know, what a 12-year-old looks like in a, you know, Tamir Rice or an eight, you know, a Mike Brown who looks like a monster, or, you know, Terrence Crutcher, who was perceived from a helicopter as being dangerous. Like, you know, I have to be concerned about what the lens is that I'm being perceived by, even in 2020, even after 70 plus million people vote for the guy that I wanted them to vote for. But then there's, and again, if you look at the 70 million people, that represents the people who voted. That doesn't represent the people who are related to them or live next door to them who didn't vote, who still believe the same thing. So it's at least 70 million people. And so having to negotiate that every day, and I wrote an essay about this, so I posted on the Facebook several years ago called What I Want White People to Know About Me. And so one of the things that I talked about in the essay was, you have very little idea of the weight that I carry into a situation. And I'm one of the lucky ones. I'm privileged in comparison. And so if I have to worry about these things, and I have a certain amount of privilege that can protect me, if I you know, insist on people calling me doctor, things change, you know, fairly quickly in those situations where it's like, oh, okay, so this is not quite what I thought it was going to be, you know. Mm-hmm. But not everybody has that weapon, if you will, to wield in the situation that is electrified by race.
Well, it's funny. I'm sure you've probably seen it. Dave Chappelle, in one of his stand-up comedy bits, tells this story about how he and a friend were walking around, and they were both stoned. And, you know, they walk up to the police officer he's like, we're not going to ask for a cop for directions, because he talks about how black people are afraid of the police. And he goes, a black man would never talk to a policeman while he's high. That would be a waste of weed, which, you know, I remember hearing that. But then, and he tells a story about it. His white friend goes to the cop, and he's like, yeah, he's like, hey, we're kind of stoned. And the officer's like, calm down. And he's like, 8th Street is that way, and then just lets them go. But the funny thing is, you know, this isn't just an American thing. Like, you kind of triggered a memory for me that my dad told me about. So my dad was a PhD student in Australia growing up. And at that time, in the late 70s, Australia was very open to immigration. And a lot of Indians ended up going there. And he had another postdoctoral candidate who was in his lab with him, who was a black person. And he told me, he said, when we would go to look at apartments, people wouldn't rent to the guy simply because he was black. Mm-hmm. And my dad finally got to the point where he had to literally call in advance and say, listen, I have a friend who's looking for an apartment. I'm going to bring him there to look at it, but we don't want to waste the gas driving there. If you're not going to rent to him, he's black. You should know that. But I couldn't know. I mean, and wow. To me, I was like, wow, this actually is not just an American thing, but it's mm-hmm. a worldwide thing. And that to me is kind of shocking that it's still there. So I guess this is a really weird question probably, but what do you think are the roots of this? Like, why is it that, you know, why is racism prevalent, particularly in America? Like, why is it that somebody would be racist against a black person? Do you think media plays a role in creating that? Like, what even causes that? What are the roots of this?
I mean, the broadest, simplest explanation is that this is the legacy of slavery and the fact that we black people in America started off on, you know, unequal footing, you know, being seen as chattel. And even post slavery, have not been able to kind of shed the history of that. And so part of what happens, I think is when you have a whole group of people that were basically, you know, labor, literally slave labor, immediately there's a distinction between haves and have-nots. We are better. White people are able to say in that situation, because if you look at it, they are not necessarily, you know, whatever your cosmology is, you know, in the eyes of a higher power, but in the practical everyday sense of it, we're better than you. And so even though the law changed about what we say about that, there's still the stain of that from the perceptual sense, but there's also an internalized stain that happens. And so tribalism, I think, is a consequence of that, where people, you know, you stick with who looks like you and who's comfortable with you, et cetera. And so you don't get a chance to develop a sense of empathy if you don't interact with people. It's harder, let's say. And so empathy is, I think, at the core, it's the soul of how we treat another person. If I know how my behavior affects you, I govern my behavior accordingly. But if I've practiced not thinking about your perception because I'm in this tribe and you're in that tribe, then I don't get a chance to do that. I don't get a chance to practice that level of empathy. It's much harder to oppress a person whose feelings you've taken into account. And so I think an answer to your question, the long answer to your question is that this history of being separate, and in some cases equal, but in a lot of cases not really. The whole separate but equal thing just wasn't really true. There's just been a lot of practice in not interacting with each other, and some things have, you know, some things change that when, you know, when you're forced to be together, you know, on a job, you know, in some ways unions help that, in terms of the bigger enemy was the guys with the money. And so collective bargaining, we were all in this together. And so in some ways that helped. In some ways, even though, you know, the military was segregated, but at some point, you know, when people are shooting at you, we're more alike than we're different, because they're shooting at us, you know? So there was a certain bonding that happened there. But outside of those, you know, very incendiary conditions, you know, we're not often forced to live with each other and interact with each other. And so that lack of empathy and internalized stains on both sides of the racial fence, I think, you know, continue to prevail.
Yeah, it's funny, because when you were saying all that, I couldn't help but think of the movie Remember the Titans. But, you know, you're talking about, you know, separate but equal. And it's interesting, because in Isabel Wilkerson's book, she says, you know, like, they created all these policies. I think either FDR, I don't remember which president it was, she said, but it was for homeownership. And she said, mm-hmm. What people don't actually acknowledge in history is almost all of the policies that were, you know, designed to move society forward and make life better for Americans actually excluded Black people. And I never knew that. I, you know, and you look at it and you're like, wait a minute, that literally is the definition of structural racism.
Yeah. And, you know, redlining and then those little subtle things that happen when you try to rent an apartment, even if it's, you know, legal to do so, you know, those things become, you know, part of the disease of living, you know, a racialized life, and it takes a toll. And we're in a place now where, let's just say post George Floyd, where, you know, there have been a number of incidences you know, for decades, you know, prior to that. But I think the influence of COVID and then us being cooped up made that a different flashpoint than Mike Brown or Tamir Rice or Trayvon Martin, even though those certainly were flashpoints, but it didn't become as global as George Floyd was. But I think that was under the blanket of COVID as an additional frustration that kind of burst that bubble. And so now there's, you know, there's a great deal more discussion about it. There are, you know, diversity trainings and unconscious bias trainings and white fragility as a bestseller, et cetera. But then, you know, you're still looking at that 70 million people who voted for the other guy who's in office still. And so as a Black person in America, one still has to be, you know, just really sanguine about it. And it's just like, oh yeah, sure. Better for sure. Better, but not great. And not as good as it should be, you know, on the eve of 2021.
Yeah. Well, okay. So let's shift gears a little bit. What I wonder is how in the world somebody who gets a doctorate in clinical psychology ends up becoming a spoken word poet and an Emmy award winning television producer. Those things don't seem to, those are not two combos or three combos you'd ever imagine going together.
No, I'm happy to talk about it because I want people to use my life as an example of you don't have to have it all figured out. And there are paths that you can make for yourself that weren't there before. And you don't have to feel stuck. You know, my favorite thing is when I hear a 25-year-old saying, "Oh, it's too late for me. I can't make it in the industry." I'm like, just shut up. You know what I mean? You're 25. The world is your oyster. Yeah. And stop tripping. You know. But I like using my life as an example because it is weird. You know, it's a strange combo. You know, the unicorn of it all. But the truth is, I consider myself a writer more than I consider myself any other thing. You know, I alluded to, you know, started, you know, writing poetry when I was 8 years old and, you know, kind of fell in love with what language could do, what I could do with language, not just, you know, as a reader, but also as someone who could manipulate language and kind of break the code of what it could do. And so that's really the foundation of who I am. And it just so happens that, you know, couldn't figure out how to make a living, you know, as a poet. That was never even a thing to consider. But it is the thread that runs through my life, being able to be a storyteller with words. So while I'm, you know, a professor at a university and, you know, running a mental health center and having a private practice, I'm still writing all the time and feeling kind of frustrated that this isn't what I'm doing for a living. And at some point I thought, yeah, I'm well-trained, you know, as a shrink and a professor, and that's going fine, but it's not fulfilling. It's not doing it for me. And here's where we circle back to, you know, my parents giving me the freedom to try new stuff. And so, you know, having a doctorate is a great plan B, frankly. And so it was easier to basically say, look, if this doesn't work out, moving to Hollywood and trying to be a writer, if it doesn't work out, you can come back and be a professor or open your private practice back up again. You know, no harm, no foul. But making the decision to leave still is the best decision I've ever made. Betting on myself, basically, to try something different, to try something that wasn't preordained by how I grew up or how I was educated. And so I moved to LA and didn't have a job, didn't know anybody in the business, knew one person, a good friend of mine from high school, but you know, he wasn't like a studio head, so that wasn't really helpful in you know, the creative hookup. And I figured it out, you know, but figured it out makes me sound like I'm smart, you know, in that way. No, I figured it out. That is, no, just stick to it. Just keep at it. And the adage of the harder you work, the luckier you get is what happened, honestly. And so I ended up, you know, tripping into reality TV at its inception because somebody took a chance on me, you know. And it flourished from there. The poetry thing continued, just because I'll write all of my life, you know, regardless of whether I get paid to do it, and started to perform a little bit more and become comfortable, just, you know, doing the performance piece of it, and you know, and so now all of those things are still, you know, alive and well.
So, I do want to ask you one question around the mental health piece, because I think that it seems like mental health and race have a very sort of interesting coexistence. And I know this through my own personal experience, because, you know, the sort of, I don't know what it is for Black people, but I'm curious, particularly as a therapist who is Black or a psychologist who's Black, the narrative that I grew up with, particularly around, you know, mental health and getting help for it, was that therapy is for crazy people. And if you saw one, God forbid that you talk about it, so much so that there was a time, and my sister is a doctor, and for some reason she couldn't refill my prescription for my antidepressants. This is when I was taking them. And I asked my mom, I was like, well, can you call a friend? I mean, you know, 1,000 fucking doctors, like everybody we know. And she actually refused. And I said, why? She said, because I don't want them to know that you're taking antidepressants.
Wow.
Yeah. And that, you know, so I wonder, when you look at mental health, particularly in the context of race, what have you seen?
Well, part of it is that same stigma. You know, part of it is that, you know, if you're getting mental health treatment, there's something broken about you in a way that's shameful, as opposed to, you know, getting dialysis, which isn't shameful, or you know, mending a broken ankle. There's no shame in that. But having a broken brain, having broken, you know, biochemistry, that seems like it's in endemic to you as a human being, and there's something corrupt about that. And so that, you know, has you know, pervaded the community, such that it's gotten better. You know, there are certainly people who talk about therapy and the benefits of it, and they're very prominent people who happen to be Black and are supportive. But you know, the prevailing narrative is still, there's something wrong with you, you know, and it's going to take a while, I think, you know, before people realize that, you know, it is a helpful and not a shameful thing to do. But yeah, you know, that's a path, you know, that's not going to be a quick fix. And you know, the media psychologists who, you know, who kind of traffic in those kind of quick fixes, that doesn't really help. I think the overriding narrative is still, no, there's something wrong with you and how you were raised or how you negotiate the world or whatever, but it is, it's still not okay. So we still have a lot of work to do. And I think that's, we just have to continue to do the work. We have to continue to tell each other, to tell our peers, to tell ourselves that we don't have this same level of shame, you know, for a sinus infection, you know, but when it's your brain, your feelings, your thoughts, that seems like something that you could fix on your own to some people, you know? And yeah. So, and with a group of people who have had reason to be wary of science, you know, whether it be, you know, the Tuskegee experiments or Henrietta Lacks or whatever, there's, you know, it's in some ways understandable, but it's also unfortunate because there is value in this thing, you know, beyond the fear of it.
Yeah. Well, I think that, you know, it's funny because you're a spoken word poet, and we're spending a lot of time talking about race. And part of the reason for that is because as I was reading your poems, I realized like this plays a huge role in, you know, your art. So I wonder, you know, as an artist and as a creative, when you think about the choices you make, both from, you know, the poems that you choose to compose, but also the projects you choose to get involved from a television standpoint, what is it that determines your choices? What, you know, when you're conveying messages, like what is important to you to get across when you make things? Because like I think about my work here, and I think to me, like what I want is to give a home to people who feel like they don't have one, particularly as creatives. Like that is because I've always felt that even in my own culture, I've jokingly said, I was like, the people I feel least comfortable around are Indians, like my own, because I feel that often this is the place where I'm going to be judged. You know, I was working on this piece about the, you know, woes of being an immigrant in the arts. And as it is, like, you know, it's discouraged, but then, you know, until you become like, you know, Mindy Kaling or Hasan Minhaj, people are like, oh, you're just some schmuck who's wasting your education.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, it's a burden, sadly. And I think, you know, my goal, look, I can't pretend that I've chosen every project because of some, you know, lofty philosophy. Sometimes I need to keep the lights on, you know, and yeah, that's just the truth of it. I'm at a point in my career now where I have more choices, and I can turn down some things that don't seem to fit, you know, what I'm trying to accomplish in the world as a creative, and so I have a lot more freedom in what I write, of course, and I'll talk a little bit about that. But in what I try to align myself with in television work is you know a type of storytelling that allows people to have conversations about what's true in the world, even if that's not necessarily the easiest conversation to have. And so that's been fortunate. I've been able to do that for the last several years. And it's what I tell, you know, the people who help find, you know, gigs for me or people for me to meet, with the hope of having a gig, is that this is what I'm looking for. I'm looking for things that have meaning in a way beyond, you know, just kind of following people around who are dating or in the soap opera of it. And I'm not trying to malign those things. Those are entertaining things. And
don't worry. I've unfortunately been not just, you know, I wouldn't say a victim of it, but I've been on one of those things. So,
oh, okay.
That's so my latest claim to fame now.
So you get it. And look, yeah. You know, people are entertained by it. And in some ways, I think there are some shows that do harm, but most of them don't. I think most of them are innocuous. But it's also not necessarily a thing that I want to do. So I make very intentional decisions around what I want to work on, and I'm willing to you know kind of sacrifice some stability in order to do that. But as a writer, I have a lot more control. So you know, the book and album Boy, a collection of poems that both of which are out now. Those are culled from lots of work, but the fillet of it really is around social justice things, not just domestically, but you know, globally. About how we treat each other, and how that isn't always the greatest outcome for some groups over others. So, looking at the othering of what human beings can do to each other is part of the soul of the book and the album. And that was important to me, not because I have the answers, but completely opposite of that, because I don't. And I think if I'm a town crier enough about certain things, whether it be race or gender or class, let's say, then maybe somebody else is stimulated by how I've talked about it, and maybe they will have an answer, or they can be in a conversation with somebody that can have an answer. At the very least, what I'm after, to go back to something I mentioned before, what I'm after is increasing empathy. And so if I can write something in such a way, whether it be from the point of view of Khalif Browder, who was in jail for 3 years, but not really convicted of anything, or you know a trans woman who is you know reflecting on all the other trans women who have been murdered in America. If I can put those things out there, maybe somebody will think about these issues in a way that they hadn't before, and maybe they can be part of a solution that I haven't conceived of.
Wow. Well, as always, Cher has knocked it out of the park and sent us yet another amazing guest. So I want to finish with my final question, which I'm very curious to see how you're going to answer this. But what do you think it is that makes somebody or something unmistakable?
I think what makes someone unmistakable is when they embrace what is unique about them. It's easy to figure out how you're part of a tribe, you know, how you want to be part of a tribe. You want to be considered, you know, one of the group, one of the in crowd, the cool kids in the cafeteria, whatever it happens to be. But I think what makes someone unmistakable, and being unmistakable is about someone else's perception of you largely. And so I think once you embrace what is unique about you, then it's hard for people to mistake you for someone else. And they have to acknowledge, whether they like it or not, they have to acknowledge your distinction in the world. But it's going to be harder for them to acknowledge your distinction if you don't. I acknowledge my distinction as this bizarre unicorn, you know, doctor, poet, TV producer. It's weird, but I celebrate that. And I celebrate that not for the narcissism of it, of which there has to be some for sure, but I celebrate that for the beacon it can be for other people to embrace their unicorn, embrace their weird, embrace their unmistakable.
Amazing. Well, I can't thank you enough for taking the time to join us and sharing your insights and wisdom with our listeners. Where can people find out more about you, your work, the book, and everything else that you're up to?
Oh, thanks for asking about that. You know, DonnieJacksonPoetry.com is a place to go, and that'll lead you to the book. Yeah, there's an album version of the book, Boy Poems, and you can find that on all the streamers, you know, Spotify and Apple Music, iTunes, Amazon. And so I invite people to read the book or listen to the album, or do both at the same time, because that's one way of experiencing the story. So yeah, I'm not hard to find in that regard. Follow me on Instagram, not because you'll learn a lot about me particularly, but I try to feature other people regularly on my Instagram, just Dr. Donnie, doctor spelled out Dr. Donnie on Instagram. So I hope people will check it out and let me know what they think, and, you know, share it with people that you think are like-minded that might get something from it.
Amazing. And for everybody listening, we will wrap the show with that.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Unmistakable Creative Podcast. While you were listening, were there any moments you found fascinating, inspiring, instructive, maybe even heartwarming? Can you think of anyone, a friend or a family member who would appreciate this moment? If so, take a second and share today's episode with that one person, because good ideas and messages are meant to be shared.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Hi. This is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. Invesco QQQ is proud to sponsor this episode and even prouder to provide access to innovation for the last 25 years. Basketball has had innovations over the years, too. We're seeing the game played in new ways every day. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.
Have you ever felt a twinge of worry about AI taking over your job or diluting your creativity? Well, what if you could turn that fear into creative fuel? We've just published an amazing new ebook called The Four Keys to Success in an AI World, and this is more than just a guide. It's a deep exploration into the human skills that AI can't touch, the skills that are essential for standing out and thriving no matter how much technology evolves. We're talking about real differentiators here like creativity, emotional intelligence, critical thinking, and much more. Inside, you'll find actionable insights and strategies to develop these skills, whether you're a creative person, a business person, or just simply someone who loves personal development. This isn't a story about tech taking over. It's a story of human creativity thriving alongside AI. Picture this: AI as your creative co-pilot, not just as a tool, but a collaborator that enhances your unique human skills. The Four Keys ebook will show you exactly how to do that and view AI in a new way that empowers you instead of overshadows you. Transform your creative potential today. Head over to unmistakablecreative.com/4keys. Use the number 4, K-E-Y-S. That's unmistakablecreative.com/4keys, and download your free copy.